Pseudopod, episode 175, January 1st, 2010, Flash on the Borderlands 2. Welcome to Pseudopod, the weekly horror podcast. I'm Ben Phillips, the chief editor. Alistair is on vacation this week. In this installment of Flash on the Borderlands, we bring you three more tales of mayhem and doom. Four, if you count this initial little kicker. It's the winner of the microfiction competition. That's fiction with a 140-character length limit. We had on the forum at forum.escapeartists.net a while back. Congratulations to Zorag, the favorite among the poll participants, whose winning untitled entry is as follows in its entirety. Listen closely. I'll never forget our first date. A perfect night, alone on Lover's Lane. Her eyes, blue. Her hair, blonde. Her lips, red, just like my knife. Our second story is by Tom Levine and is narrated for us by Jaron Cohen of SupersonicSpots.com. It's called The Desert, a fun little summer vacation story. Don't forget your baggage, because we're already on our way out and we're taking you with us.
The Desert by Tom Levine.
They haven't moved since, Dom started to say and then cut himself off. I knew how the sentence finished. Since Trish and Jack had made a run for their car parked beyond the driveway. That's what he was gonna say. Since the spiders had swarmed them. The Sonoran sun was merciless, and the electricity was off in the new house we were trapped in. Without air conditioning, we were broiling in the heat. Our cell phones collectively had no signal. Becky's father had wanted a home away from the damn city, and he'd gotten his wish. Despite the explosive growth the Phoenix metro area had undergone in the past decade, Arizona was a big state, with plenty of open space left for folks like Becky's dad. Irrationally, I hated him for this. We wouldn't be in this situation if it weren't for him. Or, I reasoned, if we hadn't decided to spend a Friday night getting hammered before the movers brought in the new furniture.
So, what do you think?
Dom asked. It was the fifth time he'd asked me in as many hours.
Man, I don't know, I whispered back, as if the arachnids could hear me. I've never heard of anything like this.
The spiders had shown up during the night while the six of us were bombed out of our skulls. At least, that's what we figured. They were already in position around the house by the time dawn broke over the mountains. I'd seen plenty of spider-related horror movies. All of them, probably. None had depicted a swarm, if that was the right etymological term, of spiders in a perfect circle. Motionless, moving only when a human dared step foot outside. A perfect circle. None had come indoors that we knew of. That didn't jibe with the horror movies. The hairy little bastards always found some crevice to squeeze in and drop down on their unsuspecting prey. Not so here. At least not what we had seen. These spiders just sat, waited, and watched us. A million billion sets of eight eyes awaiting our next attempt to go outdoors. Also contrary to my Hollywood education, these weren't some mutated super spiders. Only every species known to the desert. Black widows, strangely out of their webs, mingled with tarantulas and daddy long legs, which stayed nearby the larger grapefruit spiders and recluses.
We can't stay here,
Dom said.
I know,
I replied. We'd only brought snacks and beer. The house was otherwise empty. We'd previously discussed using duct tape around Dom's tall boots and sealing his hands in work gloves. Only to discover we had neither tape nor gloves. I knew a single bite from even the most poisonous of the spiders wouldn't be enough to kill anyone, apart from a child or the elderly, neither of which were in the house. Two, three more bites would sicken a person, but with quick attention, even several black widow bites wouldn't necessarily be fatal. How many bites from widows and other species Jack and Trish had sustained before they fell to the ground, I didn't know. We were all wearing shorts and t-shirts or tanks. Plenty of flesh for the piercing. Dom was the only one in jeans, but his arms were exposed. The venom, coupled with adrenaline, I guessed, had felled Jack and Trish 10 yards from their car. The creatures moved quickly, in mass, skittering over one another for the chance at sinking their fangs into naked flesh. Their numbers were so vast that our two friends had been slowed by the spiders as they swarmed up Jack's and Trish's legs. After Jack and Trish had fallen to the ground motionless, the beasts got back into position. Into that perfect circle around the house. If we'd stopped to think about it, it was our best chance to have escaped. While they're busy killing our friends. Dom and I were too paralyzed, watching the assault. The girls hadn't watched, and I didn't blame them.
Look! Dom barked suddenly, and I jumped. I followed his gaze and sucked in a breath. A swarm, the correct term, I was sure, of flying insects was approaching the house. They buzzed around the house briefly, then landed on Trish's car, obscuring it entirely.
Holy shit! Dom said.
Bees? I asked.
Dom nodded.
Looks like. And wasps. And there's more coming.
He pointed again and I felt my stomach lurch. 3 more separate swarms were approaching. One swarm nested on my truck, another on Dom's van. The third simply flew around the house. The low hum of their sheer numbers rattled the windows.
What's happening?
Becky asked from behind us. She didn't come close enough to see out the windows.
Nothing good,
Dom said, and Becky whimpered.
So even if one of us made it to the cars, the wasps would get us?
Couldn't kill us, Dom said. It'd take thousands of stings.
Wasps and bees didn't kill Trish and Jack, I said.
Aw, hell,
Dom said.
What are we gonna do?
Becky whined. Dom leaned back away from the window.
We wait,
he said, folding his arms.
They can't stay here forever.
Neither can we. I got a nasty look for saying that.
What if they come in?
Becky cried.
What if they...
Becky, shut it!
Dom shouted.
They haven't yet. And if they do, it'll be a good chance to run.
Dom then turned to me.
I can't back this up,
he said.
But I get the feeling if we can make it past that perimeter, we'll be okay.
I nodded. I'd been thinking the same thing, though I couldn't express why. The geometry of the arachnid circle was unsettling in its perfection, as if drawn by the hand of some 8-legged deity delineating their boundary. For what purpose, I didn't know, but it was too well marked to be accidental.
On the other hand, I said, the cars are beyond the circle, and the wasps don't seem to mind. Think they'd attack if we got past that line?
I do.
Well, shit.
Why aren't they moving?
I wondered aloud. Dom shook his head.
Don't matter,
he said.
It just don't matter, bro.
He sighed through his nose and began walking back toward the living room.
Well, wait,
he said, and disappeared. I heard him grab a beer from the cooler. Night came. I stayed by the kitchen window. There's no moon to speak of, and since the electricity hadn't been turned on yet, the landscaping lights offered no clear view of the arachnids. I did think I saw something coming toward the house around midnight, but it was too dark to be certain. At dawn the following day, I saw I'd been right.
Dom?
I called. Dom stumbled, bleary-eyed, into the kitchen, an empty bottle in hand.
What?
Look, man.
Dom leaned over the sink and peered into the morning light. The circle had expanded and changed color. From the front door to the outer edge of arachnids now measured about 30 yards, well past the vehicles. But it wasn't spiders that had joined the mass. It was snakes. Coiled, curled, and squiggled, thousands of slithery bastards had extended the boundary past the spiders. A second front. Tails rattled and tongues flickered, but otherwise the reptiles were still. Just like the spiders. And like the spiders formed a perfect circle. I recognized diamondback, rattlesnakes, and other vipers, and swallowed dryly. A spider bite couldn't kill you. But a rattler bite, or 10, sure as hell could. The snakes hadn't come alone. Scorpions, of varying shades of yellow and brown, had joined their arachnid cousins closer to the house, looking like polka dots amid the brownback spiders when viewed from a distance. The wasps hadn't left the cars.
What the hell?
Dom screamed. He threw a bottle into the sink. It shattered, sending brown shards up and over the counter. A small piece cut his hand, but Dom didn't seem to notice. My stomach growled. Despite my terror, I needed to eat. I wondered how Lauren, my girlfriend, was faring.
I'd almost forgotten her.
She'd gone into what was to be Becky's bedroom when the swarm arrived, and we hadn't seen her since. I went in to check on her. She was sleeping. Asleep or in shock. Either way, there didn't seem to be any point in waking her. I dropped to the floor beside her and hugged her close. Night came again. Our third in the house. I heard Dom and Becky going at it in Becky's parents' room. I couldn't blame them. The likelihood of getting out of the house alive was drastically diminished with the addition of the snakes if they behaved the same as the spiders when someone stepped outside. I was sure they would. So would the scorpions. It made the only sense in these perverse circumstances. If Dom and Becky wanted one last tumble before the end came, either from hunger or being attacked by the desert beasts outside, I wouldn't begrudge them. It was then that I realized that hunger was a powerful motivator. Dom and I, if not the girls, would have to try to run. The vestige of our reptilian brains wouldn't let us simply starve to death if a chance for escape were possible. We'd have to obey our basest instincts and make a run for it. I shuddered and held Lauren, trying to command my shrinking stomach to be silent. I listened for any slithering or skittering in the air vents. And heard nothing. Nothing inside. Outside the house, I heard the ravenous cry of wolves.
Don't you hate vacations that start out bad and just keep getting worse? Our next feature is a little sci-fi excursion by John Robinson, who writes for the highly entertaining entertainment blog NeedCoffee.com. This is called Benefits, and is narrated for us by a true-to-life scientist by the name of Freeman Goodyear. So make sure you've given your release forms to our receptionist. The clinician will see you now.
Benefits by John Robinson.
There are benefits to being a pioneer in the art of cloning. Cloning itself is a science. It is in the application of that science that it transcends into art. I know, believe me, it sounds pretentious, but bear with me. Let me give you a practical example. You've heard of cloning. Everybody's heard of it. You can get it done in a convenience store, waiting less time than it used to take to get a passport photo. Those booths, patented by me. Yes, that's right. Well, you have to understand, once the patent for the technique I created expired and the whole process went generic, I had to start getting creative. So, I, set aside some funds to bribe the FDA. Set the expectations of the public that yes, 1 in 5 clones might not come out just right. I mean, for God's sakes, the process is taking place in the same aisle as the toilet paper and the butane lighter refills, right? But, nobody complains, because they usually want them just for their organs anyway. Now, that keeps me able to enjoy the quality of life I've come to expect, but it's, I don't know. There's none of the art involved. I wanted something with a little bit more finesse. So, clone therapy. That was mine too. It seemed simple enough. As long as we can make a copy of you and recycle that copy as quickly as we used to do paper, why not use it to make people feel better? Again, the right amount of bribe money in the right accounts, and well, you should see some of the sessions I've seen. We've helped save marriages. Men and women who really want to do somebody else. Well, other than their spouse. Bring in a sample of their person in question. And voila. We give them a little privacy and a few hours later, a half hour for men, they leave feeling better because they know they've gotten it out of their systems. The real person will never know that a copy of them just committed adultery in another part of town because, well, we can grow you from a piece of hair, a bit of skin, fingernail clipping. Done. Person goes home, clone gets reduced to composite atoms, spouse is none the wiser. Everybody's happy. We've had guys who need to work out some self-loathing just beat the ever-loving shit out of themselves. We've even done some more extreme therapy. Take, for instance, this young couple. The wife has affairs. A lot of them. She's a serial adulterer. She'd sleep with some guy behind her husband's back for a few months and then move on. Perfectly happy at home, she just needed variety. In reality, she has a serious sex addiction, and she needed some help. If only someone had gotten her some. Because, you see, he found out. He found out, and he was absolutely crushed. He was this big guy, but gentle and caring. He could have just, I don't know, broken her neck, if he had ever let himself get mad enough, that is. But he didn't, not even after catching her. He blamed himself, the poor bastard. They went to counseling, and they tried to make it work. Story doesn't end there, though. He's miserable, all the time. Just miserable. And he doesn't know why. Sure, she cheated on him. Not that he, I don't believe, ever knew about the others, but just that one. But that was behind them, and they should have been happier than ever. But he wasn't. After going to some solo therapy sessions, the shrink decided that he, deep down, was furious with his wife, and he needed to get that out of his system in order to get on with things and be happy again. Well, he couldn't bring himself to say or do anything to her. Gentle giant, remember? Loved her dearly. So one of his buddies gave her my card. I think the guy had used my services to fulfill a fantasy he had about this pair of pop-singing twins. Won some of their hair off eBay. Anyway, that's beside the point. The point is, he came to see me. I listened to his story with great interest, and I knew instantly what I could do for him. I've done this before, of course. We could grow him a copy of his wife and let him take out his frustration on the copy, then go back home as though nothing had happened. He was resistant at first, but his wife genuinely, I think, felt bad for what she had done, and told him to do whatever it took so that they could be happy again. So he engaged my services. A few days later, he came back and we led him into a soundproof room with the spitting image of his wife, sitting in a chair. When she sprang up to ask him what the hell she was doing in my office, he backhanded her. I think he surprised himself by this, because he broke her jaw really nicely. But once he started, he didn't stop. He even started using the tools I had laid out on the table for him. Took the better part of an hour for him to, you know, get it all out of his system. But he did. Yes, he did. He came out of the room covered in what was left of her, and I asked how he felt, when he said, laughing a little, that he felt better, much, much better. I told him he should celebrate with a little wine. I poured, we drank, and he almost split his head open when the sedative hit him like a freight train. He was a big guy after all, so I used a lot just to make sure he went down. He woke up in his home to the cops breaking down his door. I had transferred him, the tools, and the remains of his wife back to his bedroom. The blood was a genius touch, if I do say so myself. I was able to replicate a spare bucket to gore up the bedroom so it looked like he had actually butchered his wife there, then curled up and gone to sleep after the deed. His story was flimsy. That was by design. I told the police. Yes, he had come to me to do some extreme clone therapy. But I had told him that he had to have the clone created on our premises. As I tried to explain to the gentleman, I told the officers, who's to say that the unconscious woman you're carrying isn't your wife and not a clone? You could be trying to implicate me in an actual murder, I said. And the cops believed me. Of course they did. A lot of them had used my services before, and they knew me well. I didn't know she was married. For the whole 5 months she was seeing me, she never told me. She just got tired of me and moved on. I was naive, but you have to understand. Working with copies of people all the time, it was nice to have a real person who loved me. It's a shame that it was all of it a lie. I have the video of the husband's session. Like I said, it's art. True art. Sometimes, though, I want a little bit more than the video, so I grow copies of the two of them, set them up like wind-up toys, and watch it happen again. Sometimes I change out the tools, just for a little variety. I even manage to fabricate copies of their wedding rings and put them on them for that final touch of realism. After she was caught, she really did turn over a new leaf, I understand. It was hard, but I don't believe she had ever gone behind his back again. Like I said, she had a serious problem with sex. It's a shame nobody ever helped her out.
Our final installment for this episode is Bird in a Wrought Iron Cage by John Alfred Taylor, whose story Got Milk appeared on Pseudopod a little while back. He was born in Missouri during the Great Depression and is currently a professor emeritus at Washington and Jefferson College. This story is narrated for us by the Doonstief crew of the Doonstief Audio Fiction Magazine, who have breathed vibrant life into this peculiar little specimen. So enjoy the story from a safe distance, please.
Bird in a Wrought Iron Cage by John Alfred Taylor. I remember I laughed when Father told me about the hand. Though when he shouted, his face mottled red and white, I realized he wasn't joking. It was another side to Dad. I had always thought him the essence of normality, brutally practical, a sworn enemy of fantasy, and now he was raving. Still waters run deep, I told myself. The cuckoo nests in any head. How would Moorcock sheet and tube survive it? But then he showed me the family heirloom, as Grandfather had shown him, and I knew Dad was his usual unimaginative self. The sight of it was better than any argument or description. He opened up the musty buffalo hide trunk, with its green-stained brass fittings, and pulled out the cage inside. For a second, I thought it held a huge brown spider, until I saw the fingernails like broken roots. Then it crawled to the corner of the cage and picked up a pen. It liked the new ballpoints. "Welcome, Frederick the Fourth. We are glad to see you. Will you give us what we want?" I didn't know what that meant, and when I did, I wasn't eager. But after Dad explained, I got out my penknife and sterilized it with my lighter. The cut didn't hurt as much as I expected, and only a few drops were necessary.
"For the form,"
Dad said, but I don't think he understood any better than I did. I held my forearm carefully over the notebook, and afterward the hand wrote under it, smearing the page. "Frederick the Fourth, his blood." So I too gained the knowledge of the hand, of the advice that had pyramided the family fortune for three generations, that had guided great-grandfather through his speculations in railways and iron, that had warned grandfather 6 weeks before Black Friday that in 1937 gave father a detailed month-by-month chronology of World War II and its investment opportunities. It was about time, since I had been executive vice president almost a year, and Dad was already thinking of retiring himself to chairman of the board. And the hand and I had a very cozy relationship. At first, I would take it a new notebook every morning, tie a string through the spiral binding, and let it down through the cage bars as per instructions. Because I once tried to do it my way, without the string, and the hand had thrown itself up to turn over in midair and claw open the ball of my third finger. I had a tetanus booster immediately and never took the risk again. But I asked it all sorts of questions, not just business questions, though I asked more of those than Dad did. After all, it was the hand and I who planned the company's diversification. All sorts of questions. I wanted to know where the hand came from, what it wanted. "What are you?" I would ask. "Where did my great-grandfather find you?" The hand would pick up the pen, shuffle and slide across the page, and all it would leave would be, "Ha, ha, ha," or "Wouldn't you like to know?" I asked Father if he knew anything about the hand, but all he knew was that we'd always had the hand, and what great-grandfather said was all there was. So I went back and read the bleached brown script of great-grandfather's diary, and learned what I already knew. Great-grandfather had paid somebody else to substitute for him in the Civil War, and made his first fortune out of quartermaster contracts, and gone west afterward. But he said next to nothing about the hand, or where he got it, though he seemed to have more to do with the Indians than your average businessman. I never did learn anything but "wouldn't you like to know," and "ha, ha, ha." Dad involved himself less and less with the company, and finally, one day in June 1966, he called me on the intercom and asked me to join him. I gave our special knock, and he let me in. We've always kept Grandfather's office as he left it. The gaudily painted safe no burglar would look at twice was open, the buffalo hide trunk on top of it, with the cage that held the hand on the desk. "What's up?" I asked.
"It's time,"
he said in a grave voice. And I noticed he looked gray, too. His face was damp and pale and his lips bluish. "Time for what?" I said, and he gestured toward the cage. The hand was capering back and forth beside the notebook, where it had scrawled, "June 19, 8:11 p.m. You will die of a coronary. Plan accordingly." It can't know," I said, then noticed Father was trying to keep himself from trembling.
"It knows,"
he said.
"It told my father, your grandfather, when he was going to die, to the minute. I said the same thing you did. And he told me I was wrong, then proved it. Pour me a drink, bourbon."
So I went over and poured him a drink from Grandfather's Tantalus. And Father died of a coronary at 8:11 on June 19th. We had planned accordingly, despite my skepticism, and Moorcock Industries went on without a tremor. By that time, I was asking the hand, "Will I have a son?" For years, Jessica and I had tried. "You will have neither son nor daughter," wrote the hand. The doctors said it was Jessica, so I made other arrangements. Every mistress knew exactly how much it was worth to bear my child. At the end, I was willing to divorce Jessica. But none ever conceived. And last week, it said I would die today. But I'm proving it doesn't know everything. I've built a fire in Grandfather's fireplace, a good hot fire. Now I'm opening the safe, opening the buffalo hide trunk. The hand knows what I have in mind. It's hanging upside down on the cage top and trying to claw me, but the handle was made long on purpose. Now the cage is in the fire. The hand is hopping angrily against the top and sides, slapping the bars so hard the cage rocks. But scorched and singed already, we'll see who lasts longest.
So, you want one for a pet? Are you sure? You're one of those people who are used to pets that try to hurt you, aren't you? Bird in a Wrought Iron Cage also appears in a collection called Hell is Murky, chock full of stories from John Alfred Taylor. Hell is Murky is available now from Ash Tree Press. Well, that's all the free fiction I got for you now. Hope you liked it. And I hope 2010 treats you better than 2009 treated me and most people I know. Or maybe it'll look us in the eye like something out of Clockwork Orange and say, "New way? What's this about a new way?" And we'll have to drill it full of horror stories to give it some perspective. Pseudopod will be back next week to help out with that however we can. This has been Ben Phillips, chief editor for Pseudopod, which is released under Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivatives License. Happy New Year to you and yours.